From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Dr. Martin Luther King's daughter, Bernice, describes the past 12 months as a year of extremes. Demands for racial justice reverberated across this country in ways not seen in a generation. At the same time, Americans witnessed killings by police of unarmed black citizens and an increasing boldness by white supremacy groups. On top of all this, black and brown communities continue to be disproportionately hit by the pandemic. On the political front, a black minister from King's Church in Atlanta is now the first black U.S. senator from Georgia. And on Wednesday, a black woman will become vice president of the United States. Today in The Exchange, how are you reflecting this year on Martin Luther King Day? What words or writings of King and other civil rights leaders are you thinking about right now? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 800-892-6477. Our guests are Jason Sokol, professor of history at UNH. He's the author of 3 books on the civil rights movement. And Jason, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks, Laura. Happy to be with you.
Also with us, James McKim, Manchester NAACP president. And James, busy day for you. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
It is, but it's a great day for celebration. Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Grace Kendeke, Program Coordinator of the American Friends Service Committee. And Grace, welcome. Good to have you too. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. Happy to be here.
Well, all of you, I quoted Bernice King there a moment ago saying it's been a year of extremes. How are you reflecting on this past year? And James, go ahead, you first.
Well, it's just been such a traumatic year. It started off with hope, and then we got into the pandemic, which put us into a different mode, a different mood. And then all of a sudden we had all these shootings, which it's nothing new, but the George Floyd murder in particular really launched us into a new way of thinking as a nation about the racism that has gone on. So I'm just reflecting on the wake-up call that so many people got, and contrast that with the events of last week and the divisions that really have been fomenting all year long and for the last few years as well. Just a year of extremes and a very rough and tumble year.
Yeah, I think that quote by Bernice King is speaking to you there, James. How about you, Grace? What's standing out to you from this year of extremes?
Well, definitely what is standing out for me is that, it's not over yet. You know, technically 2020 is over and we're into 2020. And you look at the past year with a retrospective lens because
Okay, and Grace, I apologize for interrupting, we do seem to be losing you a little bit there. So go ahead, please, if you could start over. Again, apologies.
I apologize for that. I was saying that we are still living through the pandemic. You know, it's hard to look back on the year in a retrospective way because we're still trying to survive and navigate, the challenges of having to work from home, the challenges of families who are navigating remote learning while trying to balance, essential jobs, the challenges of, what the pandemic has shown to us, which is so often Black and Brown communities having to choose between their safety and a paycheck. And so the way that I've been reflecting on this year is just in the ways that the Breonna Taylor's murder among so many. Many ways that.
Yeah, and Grace, I do apologize. Sometimes this happens in this remote world that we've all been talking about. We're going to call you, Grace, because there's a little bit of a problem with your internet connection. And again, we're all working remotely. We're hosting remotely. We're joining a show remotely. And sometimes this happens. I'm going to turn to you, Jason. How would you summarize this year of extremes when it comes to the issues that Black and Brown Americans are facing and, the new civil rights movement that we've seen in this country?
Well, I mean, the things that stand out to me are the horrific death toll from the virus, which the president almost willfully mismanaged, and as Grace and James said, took a disproportionate toll on Black and brown communities. I think in a way, you know, in a way, Americans have almost grown numb to the 3,000 to 4,000 deaths per day, which is amazing. I think we have not grown numb to the blatant and violent attack on our democracy, which happened on the Capitol, and particularly the attack on a multiracial democracy. So the attempt to call into question votes by Black people in cities like Philadelphia, Detroit, Atlanta, et cetera. I think that to me remains most shocking and perhaps most horrifying.
Shocking, Jason, even though you're a historian, you study these movements. So give us a little more there, please.
Well, you know, our democracy is very young, actually, true democracy. That is, it was only 1965 when African-Americans in the South gained the full right to vote. And we haven't seen these kind of violent attacks, I think, at the national level in the Capitol. I mean, those of us who study the Jim Crow South know about how Southern state capitals were attacked by white supremacist mobs, most infamously Wilmington, North Carolina, 1898. But we haven't seen this on a national level where the sitting occupant of the White House incites a mob to overturn democracy. So that to me, the images from that scene, and we're still getting more of them each day in terms of what actually went on in that crowd and inside the Capitol. Those still do remain shocking to me.
You know, James, you started out saying that this year of extremes, again, quoting Bernice King, started out with hope for you. What was the hope about, James?
Well, the hope was, you know, we were entering into an election year. And the hope was that we would, as a nation, rally and really recognize the divisiveness that has been fomented by the administration over the last few years and bring a close to it. We were, because of the debates, we were having discussions about the state of this nation. And it just seemed like there was such an opportunity to start coming together. And so that was the hope that I was certainly starting off the year with.
You know, every year at this time, we hear a lot of quotes from the I Have a Dream speech. You know, and today is Martin Luther King Day, so we'll be hearing a lot of quotes from Dr. King throughout the day. What other words of Martin Luther King feel especially important to you at this time? And Grace Kendeke is back with us. And Grace, go ahead. I'll throw that to you, please. What other words of Martin Luther King are you thinking about today?
Sure. So one quote that really stands out to me from his Birth of the Nation speech is that freedom is never given out. It comes through the persistent and the continuous agitation and revolt on the part of those who are caught in the system. And these words really sit with me because where we are right now as a nation, where I am and I see the rest of the country as a millennial, is that we are in a moment, in a political moment, the convergence of multiple events over, you know, the last few decades and especially over the last 4 years and especially over the last year alone with the Black Lives Matter protests demanding an end to police brutality, 1 week from an attempted coup on the Capitol and days away from an historic inauguration and the end of an administration which has reveled in separating families and really just causing chaos and devastation in a lot of communities of color. And I think it has been made clear that there are two Americas. You know, we've seen that play out really clearly on our TV screens. And the pandemic has put us in a situation where so many of us are home in front of screens. You know, we're no longer rushing. Well, we're rushing, but not in the same way going from one place to another. And what we're seeing is that there's the complicity of white supremacy at multiple levels within our society, including within the government and among law enforcement. And so listening to those words and really thinking about it, I understand that power rarely concedes. And we can't afford to wait for people to see the error of their ways. We have to show them those errors of their ways. And it takes collective organization. It takes collective coming together to say that, you know, we're going to tell you, we're going to stop you from continuing to harm us, to harm our
our communities, and we're going to build the systems that we need, and you all can join us when you're ready, but we're not going to stop doing the work.
So give us the quote again, Grace, as we focus on the words of Dr. Martin Luther King again today. Give it to us one more time.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, freedom is never given out. It comes through the persistent and the continuous agitation and revolt on the part of those who are caught in the system.
How about you, James? Again, everybody's going to be quoting from the I Have a Dream speech today. Where else do you look for inspiration, James?
There was a great speech that he gave called Strength to Love. And the quote that really strikes me is, hatred paralyzes life, love releases it. Hatred confuses life, love harmonizes it. Hatred darkens life, love illuminates it. And he always comes back to this notion of love. And love conquers all is a phrase that we also hear. And he also said, love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. And it speaks to me of, we have this us versus them mentality in this nation. And we really need to love one another. And if we don't do that, if we continue to not love one another, then we're going to continue to be as divided as we are, and we're going to continue to need to have people stand up for what is right because they're being oppressed.
How about you, Jason? What are you looking at in terms of writings or speeches that you think are especially important to know about right now? Again, everybody sort of knows the words of the I Have a Dream speech, but there's a lot more there, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, first I would say that James and Grace picked out some great powerful quotes there. I would just point out that if you look beyond the famous lines in the I Have a Dream speech, you also find some really notable ones. For instance, in that same speech that we all know, King talked about the unspeakable horrors of police brutality, quote unquote. He also talked about the whirlwinds of revolt that would strike this nation if we didn't address our injustice. So I would say that you don't have to go beyond the famous speech to find some words that are really relevant. The other speech that I think about a lot, particularly that I thought about while the Trump administration was pursuing policies like building the wall and separating migrant children from their families, I was thinking a lot about King's 1967 speech, in which he opposed the Vietnam War. And he not only opposed the Vietnam War, but he also made a call for a quote unquote worldwide fellowship, a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation. And he said that history is cluttered with the wreckage of nations and individuals that pursued the self-defeating path of hate. So I think he would call for, as James said, people within the country to show a little bit of love for one another just as human beings. But King also made a call for showing that borders between nations are artificial, and that we're all people, and that we're all humans, and that we have to start treating people beyond our borders with love and respect as well.
Listeners, we are reflecting on Martin Luther King Day today, after a year, as our guests remind us, that saw both a growing racial justice movement and emboldened white supremacy groups. How do the words of Dr. King sound to you today? What meaning do you draw from them? Do you think society needs new words to add to King's words from decades ago? Send us an email. We'd love to hear what's on your mind today. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 800-892-6477. Again, 800-892-6477. So, James, I'm going to go to you first on this one, but want to hear from everybody. Martin Luther King's daughter, Bernice, also said her focus for this year's observations was on what her father called beloved community. And I'm turning to you first, James, because you pulled out quotes that had to do with love. What is the beloved community, James? What did Dr. King mean by that?
So I think a couple of things here. First of all, what is beloved community? And I think Reverend Shirley Strong said it best. She understood the term beloved community to mean an inclusive, interrelated society based on love, justice, compassion, responsibility, shared power, and respect for all people, places, and things. Sounds kind of Native American-ish. A society that radically transforms individuals and restructures institutions. And this is a concept that really was introduced by 19th century philosopher and theologian Josiah Royce. And so it's interesting that Royce and his theology was part of the popular vocabulary at Boston University School of Theology in the 50s when Martin Luther King was studying there. So this is really where Dr. King got this notion of the beloved community. And that's what he's talking about when he speaks of, when he uses that term, that society that is interrelated based on love, justice, compassion, responsibility, shared power, and respect for all people.
What does the beloved community mean to you, Grace? I'd love your thoughts on that. And maybe also you can talk about how hard it is to create beloved community.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, definitely with what James said, you know, beloved community is one that is built on integrity, compassion, equity. And we live in a world, we live in a country where we have no shortage of wealth. We have no shortage of ingenuity. We have everything that we need to ensure our collective well-being. But what we have, what we've created instead is a society in which value is based on skin color. Value is based on the accumulation and the hoarding of wealth. Value is not based on on valuing the essential labor of, you know, of our healthcare workers, of people who are grocery store workers, of caretakers, of those who provide food and care for each of us and in different ways. And so I think that the difficulties in creating beloved community comes down to the difficulties in having relationships, because a community is a collection of relationships. And as someone who is new to AFSC, I began my role last summer, right smack dab in the middle of the pandemic.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
I was really, yeah, I was really confronted with those challenges of building relationships in a job that requires relationships in order to function at all. And so what I've found is that, I mean, A, that it is possible, you know, Zoom is an incredible, you know, medium and all of that, but it comes down to really being able to show up for one another. Because when we think about the loving relationships that we have with family members, with our children, with our, you know, our partners or spouses, you know, thinking about taking that, you know, thinking about how much time and energy that we put into ensuring that our communication is good, that we're showing up for one another, that we're creating systems of support, and being consistent in our coming together with the people that we love, and taking that model and using it and expanding it into every relationship we have with people that we work with people that we are neighbors with, the people that we are in movement with, that we show up for actions and protests and calling the government, all that. And the only way we can build that beloved community is through those individual relationships that we cultivate and we show up for. And then we use that to model, we ourselves model the community and the beloved community society that we're trying to build. There's literally no other way, because we must embody that which we want to see in the world.
Grace, to you first, but everybody else, I want to hear from you as well. How do you create, Grace, beloved community with white supremacist groups who, you know, clearly think that Black people and Jews and others have no room in America? Can you create beloved community with those people?
I mean, certainly, I think it's absolutely possible, because the one thing that is real and about being a human being is the fact that we have the ability to change. at any level of our life, at any age, we always have the ability to change the course, our thinking, the course of our the course of our lives and our behaviors. I think, though, that the question of whether or not it's my job or the work of other Black or Brown people to go into those spaces of those white supremacist spaces and those white national spaces and be putting ourselves in harm's way in order to cultivate those relationships. I don't think I necessarily think that I don't think that's my job. I think that because my job is to serve my community and to ensure my health and survival as a Black person living in America. But what I do think is that we can make the beloved community a space where you can't resist. It's irresistible to want to be a part of it because the beloved community isn't, so often when people think of, what else could there be other than capitalism? What else could there be other than, a wage economy? What else could there be other than what we have? We have a really hard time with our imagination imagining that there could be a world where everyone has what they need in order to live and to thrive. And the fact of the matter is that the beloved community is available and for all of those, all of us, even those who hate us. But whether or not it's my job to go out and expend the energy to try to bring people in who are targeting myself or my community, that's not my job. And I would say that's not the job of Black and Brown people. What I would say is that part of the work of allyship, part of the work of co-conspirators, of those of white allies and white co-conspirators, and others who also benefit from white privilege, white skin privilege, is that that's part of your work, is to bring in the people in your life that are racist or are white supremacists or whatever. It's also part of your work. It's part of our collective work to challenge and eradicate the internalized racism that we have in ourselves. And so often people think, I read Ibram X. Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. That's good. I'm all set. But it goes back to our relationship. How are you showing up at the dinner table? How are you showing up in your work? How are you showing up how are you confronting the darkness, the long night of racism that is present within our very families and our very communities. And I think that really it should be about, the beloved community comes together first, and we change and we create the world that we want through our relationships. And then over time, people can join us. But that is the collective work of our white allies and our white accomplices.
Wow, James, I'd love your thoughts on this. Go ahead, please.
Sure. So Grace said so many wonderful things, so many great things that needed to be said. And it's interesting, just yesterday at about 4 o'clock, the Kent Street Coalition hosted a presentation by Zandra Rice Hawkins from the Grand Estate Progress on hate groups in New Hampshire. And the hate groups in New Hampshire have actually been profiled and photos have been shown of them all across the country. So this really kind of hits home here for us. And this question of how do we create the beloved community, even with those that we against the notion in these hate groups. Now, groups are made of individuals. And so we need to interact with those individuals. And just as Grace said, we need to start with the people we know. Make sure the people we know who are espousing these themes, engage with them, have conversation with them. And the next question is, well, how do I do that? And I love the prayer of St. Francis that says, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, and to be loved as to love. So going at those conversations from the perspective of, I want to understand why you think this way. And that allows people to not be on the defensive, because people do things for reasons that are personal, that try to help them make themselves better. And many of these white supremacists you'll find are fearful and they're acting out of fear. That's why their actions don't seem logical. When we are fearful, we act illogically. So we need to understand first what that fear is, and in many cases, it's a fear of not belonging. And they go into these hate groups because it's a place where they feel they can belong. So we need to understand where these people are coming from, even if they're a family. Where's our family coming from who are making these kinds of statements? And then help them to work through those fears and to see the way of love.
Jason, how did Dr. Martin Luther King and his allies back in the civil rights movement, which you studied, create beloved community?
Well, I think definitely in a lot of the ways that James and Grace are talking about, I think one thing I would just continue on would be the economic justice piece. I think King thought that the beloved community could not just be comprised of individual relationships and harmony on that level, but that there had to be some baseline of economic justice and economic equality. So King, in his last year of his life, waged the Poor People's Campaign, which was his final crusade, and he saw it as a way to bring together poor people of all races. And the specific policies that King put together were probably to the left of Bernie Sanders. The billions of dollars that he proposed that the government spend on housing, on programs for hungry children, and so forth. This seems particularly relevant today. I mean, one of the heroes of this year, I think, is Reverend Raphael Warnock, who talked a lot about the need for economic justice. And in his bid for the Senate, his Republican opponent, basically said that he was a socialist. But Warnock said that his economic philosophy simply derived from Matthew 25, I was hungry and you fed me. And I think that's a lot of where King's views about economic justice began. So I guess what I'm saying is that in order to get through to people who, on that white supremacist spectrum, I think one has to show what the government can actually do for people. And I think in Joe Biden's new plan that he's unveiled, there are a lot of things in there. There's a piece to, try to abolish much of child poverty in the nation. And I think that's crucial no matter where you are on the political spectrum. I guess my big worry about getting through to white supremacists is the whole online conspiracy theory network, which is not something that Martin Luther King had to contend with, that level of misinformation. Of course, the FBI was under J. Edgar Hoover was all about misinformation in the 60s. But for instance, everybody knew that when Bull Connor in Birmingham had his men turn the fire hoses on civil rights protesters, that it was his men who actually did it. There was no alternate online narrative claiming it was Antifa or something. So I think the online conspiracy theories are, to me, really frightening. And that is a real wall in terms of our ability to reach across.
Oh, that's interesting. All right. Well, we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll explore themes of nonviolence that King talked about. As we see rising violence in our country, even since the beginning of this new year, more of our special call-in program for Martin Luther King Day. We'd love your thoughts. Share some of the words, quotes, ideas that Martin Luther King put forward that are speaking to you this year. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, and our phone number is 800-892-6477.
As a small business, we have always prioritized our underwriting for NHPR as one of the primary marketing investments that we make.
Jim Fitz, Managing Director of the Colony Group, a longtime business supporter of NHPR.
We find that our clients appreciate that support, and also we frequently hear that NHPR is where they first hear our name.
You can learn more on how to reach NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and we're talking with Black activists and a civil rights historian about how they're reflecting on this day after a tumultuous year for racial justice. So, Exchange listeners, it's your turn. What's on your mind this Martin Luther King Day? How do Kings words, so often repeated on this day, sound to you right now? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 800-892-6477. You can also use Facebook. Again, the number, 800-892-6477. We're talking with UNH history professor Jason Sokol. His specialty is the civil rights movement. Also, James McKim, president of the Manchester NAACP, and Grace Kendeke, program coordinator of the American Friends Service Committee. And listeners are writing in with the quotes and words that they're thinking about today. Arnie on Facebook posted from the Nobel Prize acceptance speech, "I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality." Arnie, thank you for writing in. And all of you, that reminds me of another theme that I did want to explore with you. Here's another quote from King. "Violence solves no social problems. It merely creates new and more complicated ones." Grace, how are you hearing King's messages on nonviolence today?
So it's definitely an ongoing, you know, ongoing discussion in movement work, you know, because what we have seen is the brutal reality of that, of Black and brown people doing nothing, sleeping in their beds, you know, going to work, trying to get to their cars and being gunned down. And that we know as a community that violence continues to be perpetuated on us regardless of what we are doing. And I think that there is tension among activists between, you know, the effectiveness of nonviolence and the need to defend oneself when confronted with, you know, violent counter-protesters or, you know, violence from police. And I think that one of the things that, you know, sometimes gets lost, because in movement work, we're always, you know, trying so hard to move forward to counter this and to react to something else that's happening, that we often don't look back and we often have to sort of like catch up, especially for, you know, people who are new coming into movement, who are new to movement work, who are new to being activists and organizers, that there is strategic and there's strategic importance and effectiveness in nonviolent, creative nonviolent action, and that it's all about strategy. That the point is figuring out who it is that we are trying, what it is that we're trying to change, who it is that we are trying, that we need to focus on to make them, to make those changes, and how do we go about doing that? And there is a wealth of tactics that one can use in order to bring attention to an issue and to bring to cause change to happen. I think, though, that so often, as well, that happens is that the language of nonviolence then becomes co-opted, and it can be used to police how communities of color respond to the violence that has been perpetuated in their communities for years and generations. And I think that it is really important that that we continue to hold the effectiveness and the necessity of nonviolence, especially knowing that when Black and brown people go out into the street en masse, we know that unless we are the ones de-escalating, unless we are the ones doing everything that we can to ensure the safety of our people that who are out there with us, and we are using techniques and tactics to keep the peace in these moments, that those who are against us, as well as law enforcement, will find any reason to enact violence on us. So it's in our best interest, and it is an effective tactic to do so. But there is no, I think that there isn't an argument between, you know, using nonviolence as a tactic, but then, you know, everyone has the human right to defend themselves. And if violence is being enacted upon you, you don't have to sit there and take it. You can do whatever you can to get out of that situation and protect yourself and protect others. But violence, so often, like King said, is the default, is the thing that we turn to first. And there is a wealth of tactics and ways that we can use nonviolence to serve our movement, to serve our causes, and push what we're trying to do and move that forward.
James, what do you think about what Grace says, that the language of nonviolence that King used so much can be co-opted?
Well, I think that's true. And it, for me, I think about what is the definition of violence. I think in this country, we mix up violence with action. There are actions that we can take and do take that are not violent actions. Just marching and protesting is an action, but that's not violence. And that's on one extreme, that just the marching. And then on the other extreme, we have the rioting that causes damage to property. That's extreme violence. And I think we want to recognize that that extreme violence, that looting should not happen, but that doesn't mean that marching should not happen. It doesn't mean that actions speaking out against discrimination should not happen. So I think Grace is right. There are a number of strategies that we need to employ, and we need to recognize that this notion that Dr. King supported of nonviolence doesn't mean we don't act. And his words have been used, his words about peaceful nonviolence have been used to say to Black people, don't march. Well, we've got to march because people don't sit up and take notice unless some action is taking place that provides a consequence for their either action, discriminatory actions, or their inaction. So that's the way I look at it.
So how hard is it, James, to stick to these principles of nonviolence when white supremacy groups, when they show up to protest, are often heavily armed?
That's a great question. And in many places, we would like to rely on law enforcement to keep the peace, to keep folks who would spread hate and violence in check. But we also know that in many places, that's not going to happen. So we do need to be prepared. We do need to be ready to defend ourselves if the violence does break out. But it is so hard because, as Grace said, our first inclination is to take action to be a little violent, because many of us are frustrated, and it's hard to contain that frustration.
Jason, I'd love your thoughts too on nonviolence as King and his allies presented it, and how, you know, they often were met with violence even though they were being nonviolent. We've all seen those pictures, you know, those black and white pictures from the 60s.
Yeah, well, I mean, King was, you know, King believed in nonviolence to his very last day. But while he was nonviolent, he was also extremely confrontational, which is, I think, the what Grace and James are bringing out in their comments. So in many of King's protests, you know, he and his colleagues paralyzed entire cities. You know, this was not... It was not a meek sort of nonviolence. It was a powerful one and a disruptive nonviolent protest. I think one thing that King found throughout the 60s, though, was that a segment of white America, and a rather large segment of white America, viewed any form of black protest as basically illegitimate. And I think that is a truth that African Americans have found in the 21st century, time and time again. I mean, for instance, what is more nonviolent than just kneeling on a football field, right? But the majority of white Americans couldn't even tolerate that. The overwhelming number of the Black Lives Matter protests this summer were indeed quite nonviolent and peaceful, and yet they were repeatedly, a segment of white America tried to twist and turn those into being again, something somehow violent. And I'll say the final thing, you know, what strikes me probably the most is that King and many civil rights workers repeatedly stressed that the greatest nonviolent weapon that Americans had was the vote. And John Lewis talked about this time and time again. And so what did African Americans and, you know, other Americans who were opposed to Trump, what did they do this year? They exercised their right to vote peacefully, nonviolently, democratically, extremely well-run, free and fair elections. And then what happened? A violent mob of white supremacists tried to overturn that nonviolent action. So I think we're finding this again and again, that even when African-Americans exercise nonviolence, that is also seen as somehow illegitimate by a large segment of white America.
A couple listeners are writing in with their quotes from Martin Luther King that they're reflecting on during this year's MLK Day. Doug in Concord writes, one of the quotes from MLK that is helping me right now, we must accept finite disappointment, but never lose infinite hope. Doug says, this seems hopeful, while also acknowledging that things are disappointing right now. Thank you, Doug, for writing. Lynn in Sanborn emails, I made a banner for Plymouth Common peace vigils and used it in other places too, with this King quote, true peace is not merely the absence of tension, it is the presence of justice. And Lynn, thank you for writing in. Coming up, more of your reflections, some of the words and writings of Martin Luther King that you're thinking about today. You can join us with a call at 800-892-6477, or you can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. How do the words of Martin Luther King Jr. speak to us at this moment? Today, it's a special call-in show for Martin Luther King Day, so join us, listeners. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call 800-892-6477. Our guest for the hour, James McKim, president of the Manchester NAACP. Also, Grace Kendeke, Program Coordinator of the American Friends Service Committee, and Jason Sokol, a UNH history professor and author of three books on the Civil Rights Movement. One more time, that phone number, 1-800-892-6477. So, all of you, Ashley wrote us from Epsom, who says, some of my friends argue that I cannot condemn violence on the Capitol if I do not condemn the protests from this summer. Ashley says, I disagree. The protests of the summer, even if some turned violent, have really deep roots and very real reasons, whereas the treasonous Capitol events, Ashley says, are wholly based on misinformation and hatred. Ooh, this is a tough question Ashley asks all of you, so get ready. Ashley says, how would MLK Jr. speak to these people, and what would he say about this summer versus this January? Ashley, great question. I'm going to go to all of you. James, you first. Go ahead.
Gee, thanks.
Yeah, that's a good one from Ashley.
So I guess how I think Dr. King would respond to that is there's a difference in the reason for the protest and a difference in the placement of the protest. So first of all, the reason for the protest, the protests of the summer were protests of against oppression and oppression that has been long lived in this country. And just to go back to one of the quotes that was just that you read before we took the break, accept finite disappointment, but have infinite hope. Now this challenge has been with us as a nation, this original sin, as some people have called it, since the nation was founded and even before. And we're not going to solve this problem next week, next month, next year, or maybe our lifetimes, but we have to try. So the protests for the summer were around that original sin and peacefully trying to raise awareness of the issues of people of color. The march on the Capitol, I mean, these people were not even where they were supposed to be. The protests were in public places, in public parks, and they got permits from whatever entities they needed to get permits from to protest. But the march in the Capitol is just, it's illegal to say the least. So I think what Dr. King would say is look at the root cause. One was done in love, the other was done in hate. And we have to look underneath the reasons for why these protests happened.
It's a tough question we got from Ashley, but a good one. What do you think, Grace?
Yeah, so I love that question, actually. It's really making me think here. And I think that Dr. King would respond in three ways. I think first he would acknowledge, he would respond to the collective pain and grief in the Black and Brown community, because what we're seeing today, you know, what so many have called modern day lynching, the killings of innocent Black and Brown people and white people as well at the hands of law enforcement, who then suffer no consequences for these extrajudicial murders. And I think that's something that people often forget, is that, you know, we have a system in place. We shouldn't, and we don't think we should have the death penalty, but we have a system in place that punishes people. And when these things happen and our systems continuously allow them, you have people who have worked for generations and decades to end this, to reform our criminal justice system. So they've gone to the endless meetings, they've written the petition, you know, they've signed the petitions, they've written the laws, they've done everything humanly possible in order to change these conditions so that our loved ones can stop being gunned down for simply existing in the world. So I think that was what he would do first. He would respond to that collective pain. He would acknowledge it. He would give words to it. And then what he would do is he would call upon white moderates to do more. He would show us the connection between the extremism that we saw at the Capitol, that white mob. That didn't happen in a vacuum. That didn't happen. That wouldn't have happened without the complicity of people who are willing to, you know, behind closed doors, speak to those white supremacist values, who are willing to uphold white supremacy through their works, through their lives, through the things that they do, but won't necessarily put themselves out on the line, are willing to do everything in the background to support and uphold it and be complicit with it, but not necessarily be the ones showing up on the day, you know, with the horned hats and the guns. And then I think he would also do the same thing that James has said about the fact that he would call and reflect, and he would demand that we see that the triple evils in the roots of oppression, that the racism, violence, and economic condition of our country are the reasons that we are in the state that we are in, and that we cannot separate we have to separate the differences between the BLM protest, which is fighting and calling attention to the brutal reality of what is now modern day lynching, and the fact that, like the professor had stated, you know, the white the violent white protesters are responding to the threat of Black and Brown agency. They're responding to the threat that white supremacy is in its last gasp, we hope. They're responding to the threat of the collective power of people who are saying, no more, we will not tolerate this anymore.
Let's go to our listeners again. And Rob is calling in from Exeter. Welcome, Rob. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in this morning.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is sort of a personal historical one, I suppose, but I certainly have been appreciative of all the reactions to the current attack and the fallout and all the good conversations that are coming from that. And I have a lot of hope to see how they all play out. But my comment is that a particular quote that's very important to me was, I believe it might have been the last thing that Dr. King said in public, and he was actually quoting my ancestor, Julia Ward Howe, and mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. And it resonates a lot with me because my ancestor had a very difficult time with her husband, my other ancestor, Dr. Samuel Gridley Howe. But it resonates a lot because having that kind of ancestry that even goes back further with ancestry with slave ownership, I think it compelled me to go down to Montgomery and to to meet an astonishing woman named Wanda Battle at the Dexter King Memorial Church, and of course to see all the great work that Brian Stevenson is doing. And I can only say that, you know, I feel as though we all need to go and to see the meaning and feel that experience of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice and the Legacy Museum, and to see the history and how it has evolved to what is going on today. And the memorial, of course, is just, there's nothing quite like it in this country. And I just kept thinking that, and saying with colleagues that Brian Stevenson, in many ways, he's I'm so grateful for him, because I think he is continuing this essential work.
Well, Rob, it's good to hear from you this morning. And you bring up another speech that is often quoted from Dr. Martin Luther King. And Jason Sokol, I'm going to turn to you because you're our historian. Some of the words that King expressed, you know, the night he was killed.
Well, that's an amazing speech, April 3rd, 1968. King had come to Memphis to assist in a garbage worker's strike. And there was thunder and lightning outside, and it's actually an amazing speech throughout. He's talking about this illegal injunction that the city of Memphis had filed against the strikers, and King talked a lot about how, you know, we're having our own brush with fascism now in our own country. King said, if I lived in China or some totalitarian country, maybe I wouldn't expect some of the democratic privileges that we have here. But he said, somewhere I read about the freedom of assembly, somewhere I read about the freedom of speech. And he goes on and on to that famous climax at the end that Rob talks about, and said he may not get there with you, but he's seen the promised land and has confidence that his people will get there. And of course, we all know the following day, the tragic events on the motel balcony. But that is just an incredible speech, especially hearing it retrospectively and knowing what happened the day after.
Yeah. Well, Rob, thank you for bringing that to our conversation today. And Bruce is calling from Sunapee. Bruce, you're on the Exchange. Go ahead, please.
Hey there. Hey, James. Bruce.
Hey, Bruce.
I hope I don't embarrass you too much, but I wanted to share a story about us, because I would like to bring this wonderful conversation back to, what does a white guy in New Hampshire do about all this? Because this is a great conversation, huge ideals, very important ideas, but what do we do? So, James, you and I went shopping once, and I should say I'm a white guy, right? I'm from New Hampshire, small town. And James and I went shopping in a grocery store in a small town in New Hampshire. And it was my first experience like this. Going into the store, from the moment we hit the door until the moment we left, everyone in that store looked at James. Everyone and watched him. Everybody was, you know, seeing what was this black man going to do in that store. And James is not a threatening guy. James is a wonderful guy. You know, he expresses the love that he has for everybody. It's all over. You can see it. But yet, everyone was suspicious of him from the moment we got there to the moment we left. And when we got back to the car, I sat there for a moment and I said, James, I'm sorry. For everybody that looks like me, I'm sorry. I had no idea what this is like. And that moment in that store changed my life.
Wow, Bruce. Thank you so much for calling. And I'm sorry to say we only have about a minute left. So I think I'm going to turn to you, Grace, actually, because you talked about what you'd like to see white people do beyond, you know, reading books in their book clubs and saying, yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, no, I think that the important thing that, you know, because I'm on this journey myself, right, as well. You know, I have loved ones, white loved ones in my life, you know, friends and family that I'm in continuous conversation with around race, and how they can show up for me, for, you know, other Black and brown people. And it's a process. And I think that, you know, approaching it with love, approaching it with care, approaching it with really radical honesty, and being able to confront that, you know, there is a lot that we can do. You know, there's a lot, and, you know, how ways that your values as an anti-racist, how is that reflected in the way that you spend money? How is it reflected in the way that you spend your time? How is it reflected in who you support and when you support them? I think it's all about being really reflective in how you show up for Black and brown, the Black and brown community, and the Black and brown people in your life. And those are really specific and concrete and material things. And it's going to look different for everybody. But I think once we really start to ask the question of that, like, how do we show up for one another? How do I show up with my money and my time? Then we really start to get at the heart of, like, these are the things that I can do. You know, these are the ways that I can defend you if I need to. And these are the ways that I can support you continuously through my actions and my behavior.
Well, Bruce, thank you for calling in about that friendship moment with James. And if we had more time, I might get a chance to ask him how it changed his life. But we have run out of time. Jason, James, Grace, thank you very much for being with us. Today's show was produced by NHPR's news host and producer on The Exchange, Jessica Hunt. Again, thanks for everybody who wrote and called in. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.
I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but unify.
After a turbulent transition of power, Joe Biden now inherits many challenges in a divided nation. He's set to be inaugurated on the same stage where rioters overtook the Capitol. I'm Rachel Martin. Join NPR Wednesday for special live coverage of the inauguration from NPR News.
Coverage begins Wednesday morning at 11 on NHPR and NHPR.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Lexus, presenting the new Lexus IS Sport Sedan, featuring sport-tuned suspension and optimized adapt variable suspension. Lexus, experience amazing. Cloudy, a chance of rain showers for today. High temperatures from around 28 degrees northern New Hampshire, ranging to 42 degrees in the south. Mostly cloudy tonight. Lows from single digits in the north country, ranging to about 20 degrees in southern parts of the state. I'm Dan Kogan. Good morning. Up next at 10 o'clock, it's 1A here on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.